Hi everyone, and it's another weekly call of the Zone File Access Advisory Group. Let me jump right in and acknowledge the folks who are dialed into the bridge. We have Jonathan Frakes, Tatiana, Vladimir, Rick Wilhelm, John McCormick, Barry Cobb, Mikey O'Connor, Mark McFadden, Dave Piscatello, Rod Rasmussen. Did I miss anyone? Hearing none, why don't we move on to the agenda, which is actually posted on the Adobe Connect link today, because I think we're going to look at we're going to use Adobe for a couple of other items as well. Mark, do you want to go ahead and talk a little bit about the poll results?
Sure. I'm happy to, Craig. This morning I closed the poll that we started, I think, a week ago as a result of the call on the 22nd. Results of the poll, I sent in a mail message to the list, but let me just quickly review them here on the phone. There were 11 people who voted, 11 separate people who voted on the poll. 10 out of the 11, or roughly 91%. We're in support of the hybrid model. One person voted no, that they weren't in support of the hybrid model, but that person said, actually made a long comment about the hybrid model, and his, well, it so happens I know who it is, but his comment was pretty much a comment regarding funding. And the last thing he said was, should ICANN indicate that they're able to run the clearinghouse or otherwise absorb the costs, I will gladly accept the hybrid model. So that's sort of a provisional acceptance. In most groups, we'd call that consensus, that you had everyone but one agree to the hybrid model, and even that person said, with some changes or a particular set of circumstances, they would accept it. As I said, the poll is closed, and one of the things Craig did this morning was send out some stats about participation in the advisory group. What's interesting about that, I think, is that 11 people voted in the poll, and 12 members of the advisory group have participated in more than 50% of the calls. So I think that's a fair reflection of both the state and the interests of the advisory group. And I think, Craig, I'll just, if there are any questions, I'll take them. Otherwise, I'll pass it back to you.
Thanks, Mark. And I appreciate you sending around the poll information. When you did, I pulled together those stats, and I agree with you that correlation between what the poll produced and what we had in the way of participation are, you know, remarkably similar, which I'll give us a good feeling that the direction we're headed in is be the right one. Are there any questions at all about the poll or about any of the stats that have been provided?
This is Rob. Just one question. How many people did we have in the overall working group?
Well, we had 26 people who submitted a statement of interest. We had two members who were subscribed along the way, so unsubscribed, that is. It's really 24. And of the 24, four never participated in a, never attended a call. So just say there were almost 20 who participated, or 20 that participated in at least one call. 12 members participated in more than 50%, and 8 members participated in more than 75%. There was actually a significant number that participated, 10 in less than 30%. Oh, I don't know what you want to make of those.
Craig, this is Mikey. I think one thing you might want to check, some of the members joined late, and so they might have, you know, like Rick, I think, came in late, and you might want to just correct for percentage of the time that they were actually in the group.
I could look at that, sure.
You know, I think that might get that percentage up just a little bit for some people.
So, let's move on. You know, One of the items in part two of the agenda, it's item 2.3, when we talk about are there minority positions that should be reflected, and to the extent that members have them, I think we should include it. I think we should include them. But at this point, I think it's fairly safe to say, and I turn to Rod and Vlad as the co-chairs to say that there is consensus that the hybrid model is what this group should put forward in its paper.
This is Vladimir. Apart from the fact that I'm a co-chair, I am also the person that you mentioned that acted contrary to the consensus and contributed a minority position. So I think it's my issue with the hybrid model is really small. I think it's all curable, and it shouldn't even be called a minority position. I think if we reflect that, I think we just need to find appropriate wording for the funding issues, and everyone will be happy with it. So, from my point of view, we have a clear consensus here, and obviously the paper which Mark produced, I think it's excellent. I'm almost happy with it.
I'll mirror Vladimir's comments there. I think, knowing the history of some of the working groups I've been in and heard about, we'll probably hear somebody who didn't chime in come in with something. So I think we should keep a little room open for somebody to make a comment or two. But I think we've got a pretty clear consensus here on a model that works, at least is acceptable to everybody. I was going to say one other thing that we might want to do is have, that this is model as we've come to as an acceptable model for everybody. There may be some people who had some strong opinions about a different model they would prefer, and if so, we probably want to allow that to be just recorded for the record, as it were, so that's taken care of as well. But I think we're in pretty good shape.
Yeah, I would suggest that if anyone who doesn't support the hybrid model or has concerns about specific elements of the hybrid model, that they put those in writing, back to the group by Tuesday, so we can figure out how, if at all, those kinds of comments or remarks should be included or would be included in the paper. So that being said, why don't we move on to item number 3, which is the draft strategy paper that I echo Vlad's remark that Mark did an excellent job pulling this together. I know a bunch of people have already submitted some comments, and that the overall plan is to get comments from folks by Tuesday, send them around and recirculate by Wednesday, have another discussion about this next Thursday, and then be pretty darn close to saying we've done what we've been asked to do and turn over our work. So, Mark, I'm going to pull up a copy of
Mark, are you still there?
Sorry, it's the mystery of the mute button there, Rod. Thanks. basically, what I want to do here this morning is just present the draft and what my how I tried to accommodate what I thought was the consensus of the group. Let me stress that this is just a first try. This is you know, one person's attempt to bring together many of the thoughts that the group has had, and so any things that are missing here or are poorly stated, that's entirely my fault. Am I in control here?
You are.
Oh my goodness, this is
more
power than I should be allowed to have. So let me talk first about the organization of the paper. The idea here is to, in a very simple way, to get us to the point where we're done. My goal is really to summarize what the consensus is of the group and make sure that there's enough information in this paper so that the people inside of ICANN who are working on the applicant guidebook can extract from this paper what they need in order to put into the applicant guidebook appropriate information about zone file access. So that's the idea. Also, I recognize, and I hope this is clear from the document, that there will be people who are reading this who do not have a lot of background in terms of zone file access and the discussions that we had. And so that's why, especially in the front sections of this, you see that it for people who are very familiar with our advisory group, this will seem like repetitive stuff and kind of elementary. I can assure you, for people who have not been participants in the group, this will probably be useful stuff. So that's why there's a section in the beginning called What is the Problem to be Solved? And then second of all, a very, very short, hopefully pithy and crisp section called What is the Solution? And the idea behind What is the Solution, and I'm just going to, I'm not going to go there yet, but What is the Solution? We simply talk about what the word standardization means to us as an advisory group, what the word clearinghouse has come to mean to us as an advisory group, and then explain why the combination of the two provides real tangible benefits. That's the idea. So it's a very, very short section, but the idea is that there will be some people who don't read any farther than that. They actually say, okay, here's the problem, here's the solution they came up with, and here's why they think it's the best solution. So that's the idea behind sections one and two. Section three is a discussion of the roles. It's really a definition of what the zone file consumer, data provider, and clearinghouse are. Basically, the idea there was to give precise definitions of what each one of those roles was. And then section four is really the most important part. I can see I've botched the numbering again, but let me sort of go through it here. The section four, which is titled "What are the key features of the hybrid ZFA model," addresses John's subgroup's text on standardization and attempts to incorporate all of those. And then the next section, 4.2, which talks about the clearinghouse, is basically repurposing of Dave's material, talking about how the clearinghouse would work. And then finally, section 4.3 is a section on the actual access mechanics. You know, imagine that you've got credentials. Now what do you do? The remaining sections are, there's a short section here called Implications for Existing and Legacy TLDs and Their Customers. That's really to wrap up, it's a couple paragraphs long. The idea behind it is to wrap up some of the discussions that we've had in the last 2 weeks where we brought up the question of how do we cope with the fact that we have legacy TLDs and legacy customers. Do we make it mandatory? That was a word that had come up in last week's discussion and so forth. And then finally, and I apologize for this, I'm just seeing this morning, there should be a section 5.0 called Next Steps. It's mislabeled here. For the people who are on Adobe Connect, you can see it at the bottom of the screen. There's Next Steps, inclusion in the applicant guidebook, and implementation planning. Also, there's a pair of appendices. One is I left the blank page, and this is a conversation we can have later on the call. I left a blank page for some notes on the cost model. I think that the advisory group has done so much good work on a cost model that it would be a shame to not acknowledge that in the strategy paper. And then finally, almost every ICANN paper has a listing of who the participants are. So let me very quickly go through the document and sort of hit the highlights. I don't want to really do a dramatic reading or anything like that. Section one here, what is the problem to be solved for people, again, who are on Adobe Connect, really is a restatement of the problem statement that we agreed to in January. It's got exactly two words different, and so that's where it came from. And one of the things, if you reflect on what's in 1.0, really the advisory group did a pretty good job. I think that's the really positive thing. Then what I wanted to do for people who were just coming to this and had never really worked with the Zone File Access thing, a Zone File Access issue, is to describe the solution. So the next section, section 2.0, basically tries in relatively crisp English to describe what the solution is. And it says basically what we've been talking about on the phone for months now, that the solution is really a combination of two strategies: standardization, the very, very lightweight clearinghouse. And so I try to say in English in section 2.1, well, what does standardization mean? What in the world are you talking about there? And so there is an italics of my description of what standardization is. And then a lightweight clearinghouse is not going to be something that everyone is familiar with. And so the next section, 2.2, is a quick description of, again, not a technical description because that comes later, but a quick description of what a lightweight clearinghouse role is supposed to be and what someone who was not familiar with Zone File Access might understand that to be. And so once again, in italics right in the center on the top of page 5 is my description of what the lightweight clearinghouse is. I'm very, very interested, by the way. I'm very, very interested in any comments at all. But one of the things here is that as you consider sending Craig and I comments about these sections, the definitions here, remembering that we're addressing an audience who's potentially not aware of all the work that we've done, if I've got something wrong here in terms of standardization or got something wrong here in terms of the clearinghouse, I welcome comments along those lines. Then section 2.3 I think is important. Excuse me. It actually talks about how this solves the problem. I mean, the idea here is that, well, the advisory group did a lot of work, it identified a solution, but exactly how does it solve the problem? And so 2.3 is intended to sort of encapsulate the discussions we've had in the last month, talking about why we sort of landed on this hybrid solution. I won't go through it. That's the idea behind this, and really I do believe that there will be people who read about this far and then say, oh, well, they did a good job. You know, that seems perfectly reasonable. Then there is sort of this very sneaky section, 2.4, which talks about does this apply to existing consumer-provider ZFA relationships? And I have just two sentences here. This is something also I welcome comments on. I listened to the recording. I went through my notes from last week, and I sort of took a look at this, and I sort of said, well, what did we sort of agree on? And those two sentences there in 2.4 is what I sort of came to believe that we agreed on. Then section 3 starts really the technical part of the strategy paper by describing the roles of the three parties who are involved here, the consumer of the data, the provider of the data, and the clearinghouse itself. These are taken from a paper I wrote a couple weeks ago and contributed to the list, and this is the only thing that comes out of that paper. The rest I've discarded. It's important, I think, to have a crisp definition of what the roles are. In fact, a long time ago, back in December, even before that, as it turns out, Rod's initial paper actually has the roles laid out, and what I've done is basically, based on my understanding of our discussion, sort of tighten them up a little bit is what I would say. Then section 4 is really where the meat of the paper. Section 3 is the roles. Section 4 basically says, well, look, what we're proposing here is, and I'm going to just, if you hold on for just a second, I'm going to take 5 seconds here. Okay, thanks. Section 4 here basically describes the hybrid model as standardization of access methodology. So, once again, standardization of access methodology is kind of a jargony phrase, but now we're to this part of the document that I think has to be technically accurate and crisp. And then standardization of data formats, okay? And then finally, what I call here the clearinghouse function, a simplification of the initial administration for ZFA and identity management, also, again, supported by this very, very lightweight clearinghouse. Now, Section 4.1 is my adaptation of the work that John and his subgroup did on standardization. And it turns out that that work was outstanding, and most of the words that are in Section 4.1 come directly out of the contribution that John and his group gave us. So when you see, for instance, Section 4.1.1 in terms of method of access, I'm basically taking all of those words simply right out of John's contribution. The same is true for all these sections in terms of access standards. The idea here is to group the standards in such a way so that it's actually fairly easy to understand what is being required in the ZFA requirement. Then after access standards comes a section that's fairly long, 4.1.7, which is file and format standards. And this is also coming directly from John and his subgroup's contribution from a few weeks ago. This is actually a pretty detailed description of what the file formats should be. And if you remember John's posting, you'll remember a section sort of 5 pages in that had this stuff in. I've actually included it in the strategy paper verbatim. I've made almost no changes to it. There is a section right here where the following practices are specifically not permitted. That's a section in which these are sort of my words, if you will. Then there's a section 4.2 that comes from a completely different contribution. So we've in the paper, we've identified the roles, and then we've identified the access and file and data format standards. And now it's really time to provide a technical description of how the clearinghouse works. And for that, I really took Dave Piscatello's contribution, and I didn't do much to it. I reworked it a little bit, but a lot of this material is verbatim from Dave's as well. So 4.2 is simply introductory material, but 4.2.1 is really intended to be a description of how it is that a ZFA data consumer goes about making a request of the clearinghouse for credentials. There are some words in here that we've already had a conversation about, and so it'll be important for the advisory group to look carefully at this and decide whether this really matches what we have as consensus. So I leave that to you as you look at the document in the coming days. Once an applicant has been approved, Dave had a very, very lengthy section where he talked about, well, now that someone has been approved for zone file access, and remember, approved is a funny word in this setting, because as long as you agree to the legal documents and haven't done malicious conduct, you're going to get approved anyway. But for the approved applicants, then there is a set of work that the clearinghouse has to do. And what Dave's provided here is a very crisp definition of what the next steps are. Then, if you read through this, this is basically a credential management and configuration. That's what's going on in 4.2.2. And once that's done, then it behooves us to actually say, well, then once you have your credentials, how do you get into the system? And so 4.3 is actually a section that describes, well, once you have credentials here, then here's how you actually get into the system and get the zone file you're looking for. It sort of doesn't reprise the fact that the data formats and the mechanisms are in section 4.1 in the standardization section. It just refers to that. Then the next section here, 4.4, is intended. There we go. 4.4 is really intended to be a short discussion of what the implications are for legacy TLDs and their customers. And if you remember early on in the document, I have two little sentences about this. And this is an expansion of that. The idea behind that and the advice, again, very, very definitely welcome comment on this. The idea behind the two sentences that are very early in the document is that you and I, all of us on the call, know that some people will just read the first three or four pages, and then once they get to the technical stuff, their eyes will glaze over and put it aside, knowing that we've, you know, done the best job we could at solving the problem. For the people who are really interested in the technical part of this and perhaps the policy part of it, I think it behooves us as an advisory group to have a little more discussion of what our intent was for the legacy TLDs and the people who have legal agreements, customer-provider agreements, between a consumer and a registry. And so those four paragraphs are there. There's also the last two paragraphs are my attempt. I don't know if Rick Wilhelm's on the call, but is my attempt really to capture some of the discussion in the last 2 weeks about the fact that there is independence for the registry, that nothing in the zone file access work prevents a registry from developing services on its own or entering into a relationship with a consumer on their own. Nothing is like that, and so. The last two paragraphs are really a restatement of part of the premises that we've been working under all along. So, once again, I very much welcome comment on Section 4.4. Now, I apologize in the documents that I distributed. The numbering is off. This is supposed to be Section 5.0, Next Steps. I thought it would be helpful in the strategy document because it's just a moment in time to indicate what our intention as an advisory group was for the next steps. And clearly, one of the things that we're interested in is ensuring that what is in this paper provides enough guidance to ICANN for the zone file language that will be in the next version of the applicant guidebook. And also, very importantly as well, there's a section here which will be 5.2, the draft of people who are on Adobe Connect see it as 4.2. Clearly, one of the things that will have to go on is that now that we have the strategy paper in place and once we've edited it and agreed it and sent it on its way, there'll still be some implementation work that has to go on. And that implementation work will be very important, much more detailed than what you see in Section 4 of the strategy paper, which is really intended to say to ICANN, thank you for getting us together. Here's the problem as we understand you put to us. Here's the solution that we recommend to you, and here's enough details for you to move forward. I think that that's what the strategy paper is all about. It's a recognition in 4.2, for the people who see Adobe Connect here, a recognition that there's more work to be done, that the detailed implementation work still has to take place, and the advisory group recognizes that. Finally, there's two sort of little things at the end. I genuinely believe, and this is not my role as a staff person at ICANN, this is just an individual comment of someone who's been working with you for the last few months. I think that the work that went on with the cost model is actually outstanding work. I haven't been on too many committees that so carefully considered what the implication of costing is for a new service in ICANN, and then thought so very carefully not only about what the costing model would be for that, but also what the implications were in terms of policy and strategy for that. I think this advisory group's done an excellent job. And I think that ought to be recognized in the strategy paper, but I'm not sure how to do it. So I left a blank page. that's my contribution, a blank page. And maybe after our conversation, when Rod sort of takes us through the Excel spreadsheet and the model, maybe we can decide what to put here. In fact, that's what I'll ask of the co-chairs. It could simply be a reference to the model, a description of the model, a description of the model's results. I just wasn't sure what to put here. But I think the work is so good, and the advisory group did such outstanding work there, that it ought to be recognized in the strategy paper. And then finally, as always with an ICANN paper, there's a list of participants in the group. You'll see this in the next draft. This actually looks a lot like the list of participants that were in the original concepts paper. Let me just sum up a couple things here, and I'm going to, this is for people who are on Adobe Connect, this is going to go very fast here. I hope I'm just going to go back to the table of contents quickly. The most important thing to me is that everyone who's participating in the advisory group see this as the first draft and don't feel like don't feel any inhibition to making comments, suggestions, or criticisms. If there are things that are missing, I'm very happy to take care of that. One of the things I say to other committees that I'm involved in is that while I'm very happy to work with the advisory group, I have no ego involvement in this draft at all, so that if you have criticisms or things that you want to change, I am perfectly happy to do it, and I really welcome the comments of the advisory group. The next thing that's helpful to me is overall organization of the paper. If there are things, again, that are missing, that would be helpful to know as well. The plan here is for you to take some time to take a look at it, to make sure that it is congruent or mostly congruent with what your expectations were for the consensus around this particular model, and that it does the job of reporting back to ICANN on what we as an advisory group think the right model is. The goal is for you to have your comments back to me and Craig, or especially helpful would be if you have comments to send them to the ZFA mailing list. If you don't want to do that, feel free to send them directly to me, but the best comments of all are comments that start a discussion, a little like the comments that we had yesterday. And then the comments that I get by next Tuesday, I'm going to take about 24 hours or so, or maybe not that long, but some time to actually turn them into the second version of the document so that once again we can have it available on the call for next week with the idea that you'll have a redlined version plus a clean version in front of you, and we can see how close we are to achieving some consensus on the document. And then at that point, it'll be up to the co-chairs to schedule the party and arrange for all the drinks. I just take the silence to mean that that's more consensus.
Mike, did you want to say something, Mikey?
No, I was applauding A, McFadden's document, and B, his suggestion that the co-chairs are buying drinks.
So let me finish up with this, Craig, and I guess I'll hand it over to the co-chairs in terms of how they want to proceed. What my goal was today was really to present this early draft to you. I'm very happy to have comments on it now or to sort of talk about it, but I think it's very short time. I mean, I just gave it to you yesterday afternoon, and for those people who are on the call who haven't read it, I completely understand that, and I'm very sympathetic. All of us have got way too much to read. And so what my goal was really to just explain what the outline was, why the pieces were there, and what they were supposed to provide, and then give you that as background so that when you do have a chance to read it and put your comments in, that you understand where stuff was coming from. So let me turn it over to Rod and Vlad or Craig or whomever. I'm certainly open to comments and suggestions, and I guess that's my overview of the document.
Thanks,
great,
Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
And I want to compliment you on the organization of the way you presented the information. It's really clear. I think it flows really nicely, and it speaks to those who have limited knowledge about what the work of the group has been, and also obviously includes everything that's been contributed by the members of the group. So I think the flow in particular is really, really helpful, and I want to say thank you for that. And as Mark commented, the draft was just circulated yesterday. I know that some folks have already turned around some comments. I know that ICANN is also looking at a version of it right now and will provide some comments, although the two-second message that I got last night from the person who's reviewing it said that they thought it looked really well organized and was quite thorough. So we'll have comments from ICANN as well. So I wonder, I think we should probably take a little bit of time right now before we move on to Rod's cost model demo. I think we should take some time. Actually, I see Rick Wilhelm's hand now raised in the room, so why don't I give Rick a chance to speak?
Oh, that was a preemptive hand raise, thinking that you were throwing the floor open for comments. So
I am throwing the floor. So we've got Rick, and then we've got Barry, and then we've got John so far. Yeah, Rick.
Yeah, quick draw. So this has to do with a comment that is expressed in the strategy paper in 4.3 about ZFA access mechanics, and it's related to the question that I posed on the list. I think it was this morning, or maybe it was last night. I don't recall. And it's about this notion of when after the clearinghouse says that okay, a particular consumer is okay to get the zone files, and they've approved their stuff, and they're going to issue some credentials. And my read of it is that so let's say I issue a login and password as part of these credentials, and I match it up against an IP address from whence the user is going to be accessing the system. And it sounds like the login and password that the clearinghouse will issue will be the exact credentials that the subscriber uses to access the data at the particular registry. Is that correct in what we're expressing there?
Well, this is Mark. I don't know if Dave's still on the call. So that what you just described is consistent with what I the way we were moving forward. That
okay.
I guess what I would say here, Rick, is that you've read the text correctly.
Yeah.
Now whether that's consistent with the way we want it is another question.
Right. Okay. So the thing that I would offer in that regard is that that implies that the authentication mechanism for each registry has to be, you know, that any local constraints that a registry might have about username and password policy and things like that have to be centrally managed and agreed upon. And also it means that a user would have one set of credentials that gets them into all of the registries, and that there's both good and from a security standpoint and operational standpoint, there's both good and bad around that. And the alternative that I would suggest for discussion is that the credentials that are issued by the central clearinghouse is not the literal credentials, but more of an authentication token that the registry can use to authenticate the fact that, yes, in fact, this consumer has been approved by the centralized authority, and then the registry can issue credentials to that particular consumer. I think that approach puts much less of an onus for change on the individual registries, and also allows for the centralized clearinghouse to not have a requirement of being operationally involved in every transaction. So I'll sort of stop my comments there and let others chime in with their opinions on the topic. But that's a suggested change, I think, to what we have currently on paper.
This is Dave. Can I get in the queue?
Sure. If you want to speak right to that, why don't you go ahead, and then we'll get back to Barry and to John.
Okay. You know what you're suggesting is something sort of like a Kerberos light, and I don't have any problem with that. One of the things that we're trying to do is leave some of those options relatively open, and certainly could include both. The question I have back for you, Rick, is one of the goals for having the clearinghouse would be to have customer care in the area of things like revocation and recovery. And so if we distribute the model where we have a token that is opaque to the clearinghouse, and the consumer wants to or says, I lost my password, then the registry is back in the business of doing password administration. And I think part of the tension here is to try to understand the extent to which we want to have the clearinghouse take over identity management so that all the registries don't have to deal with it, and versus leaving registries who have already implemented these systems to not have to touch their systems almost entirely. And
yeah,
somewhere along the middle, there's probably a balance.
Yeah, but well put, and I think you stuck your finger right on it, right? So the model that I'm talking about has the central clearinghouse much more responsible for authorization and not sort of real-time, day-to-day authentication. And you're exactly correct, and that which I'm proposing would not have the central clearinghouse in the business of revocation and recovery, as exactly as you mentioned.
Well, understand, when I say revocation, I'm not saying that the clearinghouse would actually make the decision. The clearinghouse
would implement it, that they would have a faucet.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think there's a value in both. There's a value in both models. But just to be certain, the idea of issuing the password through the clearinghouse has kind of evolved to literally be, here we've created them for you. From now on, Mr. Registry, you don't have to consult us unless there's some sort of change on your part, meaning a revocation, or a change on our part, meaning the customer wanted to have new credentials issued.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a very, very light touch. In fact, while we mentioned like once every 24 hours, it could possibly be only on change. So I think that there are a whole range of possibilities here that we can explore. And while John Levine and I have actually talked about this on the mailing list a couple of times, I'm not married to any of these. I just wanted to put out a couple of straw men, and I wouldn't be surprised or disappointed if even those that we've talked about today didn't get morphed in some manner to provide a good balance between giving the consumer some relief from having to do a lot of management on his end, and also giving the registry some opportunity to minimize change.
Yep. And so that's sort of a fair point, and we might be sort of approaching a thing where we've kind of bottomed out in terms of the strength of the decisions that we want to make, and so then maybe if we end up proposing kind of a couple of alternatives, then maybe the next question is, well, in what form or venue do those things get decided upon? If we're going to sort of say, okay, well, here's how far we're going to take the recommendation, and if we leave it down to this open question, is that far enough, or do we need to drive that extra bit and get to a final decision on what we think about the operational implications of this are? I don't know who that's to, but I agree with your point, Dave.
Barry, do you want to go ahead?
Sure. Thanks, Craig. I just got a couple of actually small questions more than comments about the paper, but I will say the comment that I do have about the paper is great work. I read through it, very well informative, and I do like the structure, and it lays it out very well. I'll start with my second question first, because we're kind of talking about operational / implementation, and perhaps not for this paper particularly, but I'm just curious, or throw out the question, would it benefit us to include some sort of sizing effort for the service and support for the clearinghouse component? So specifically in relation to 4.2.2, We're starting to frame up some of the customer service components about gaining the access and those kinds of things. Would it benefit to size what that effort might be for this third party? Would it be one FTE, two FTEs, and here's kind of the rough things that they would do? And then I'll come back with my first question in a second.
Yeah, to me, Barry, this is Craig. You know, to me, those are definitely implementation details, and I just don't know how much value there is in starting to size that up now. I think that's something that needs to be done when we figure out the mechanics of how to make this work. You know, obviously that has an impact too on what the cost is and how it's paid for. But I actually don't see needing to do further sizing now, and I'm open to the fact that I could be wrong and that others have an opinion about this.
Okay, thanks. And so my first question in relation to Section 4.1.6 about frequency and timing, there's a small statement in there, and I think this probably came from the standardization subgroup, and I may have missed it. But it says in there that for the smaller registries that there's a minimum of once per week for posting of the zone file access. Can somebody just enlighten me about why the once per week instead of once per day in relation to the smaller registries?
Thanks, Jay. I actually raised the same question in my written remarks. Mark, do you know where that came from?
Yep, I know exactly where it came from. I made it up.
Yeah.
Thanks. No, there is.
Change your mind.
There is some different language that's actually in the standards group that actually talks about, in terms of timing, variable timing, recognizing that some zone files are going to have a lot of churn, and other zone files are not going to have much churn at all. And apparently, the standardization group talked about this for a while and made recommendations about having specific minimum timings. And so it appears in the document that John wrote, but it doesn't. There's no words around what the timing should be. And so the honest truth about this, Barry, is I made it up. And I'm very happy to have this either changed or eliminated or made more precise, I think, is really what would be most helpful.
Okay, understood. Thank you.
John McCormick, you are next in the queue. If you're not there.
On Section 4.1.5, Access Standards Compressions, I think that BZIP is a typo in that. It should be GZIP.
Okay,
since while the CFA Access Advisory Group noted that BZIP 2 is slightly more efficient than BZIP, it should be GZIP there.
Okay. Great, thanks.
Okay.
I don't see any other hands raised up. Go ahead, Vlad.
Yeah. My comment is in regards to Section 4.2.1. Whether anyone, in my point of view, it's in regards to the process of entering into the agreements. So in my point of view, there are two solutions, one of which is elegant, the other one is a bit, at least for me, it looks a bit ugly. I mean, whether the process is electronic or the process is paper-based. So shall we perhaps provide some comments in regards to whether the operations of the clearinghouse should be rather be electronic or rather be paper-based, or what's the basis for deciding what it should be?
Let me explain what my background was for that. I reflected on the fact that the existing ZFA agreements that people sign now are paper-based. That doesn't mean that it couldn't be electronic in the future. but I was simply, all I did in this section was simply sort of extend the existing regime, if you will, the existing approach. And so I think that if we want to put a statement in here that says that the process that is identified in these three bullets is electronic-based rather than paper-based, I'm completely fine with that. I don't have a problem with that. The other thing is I think that we should check with someone that has slightly more legal experience.
So this is Dave. There's actually a middle ground here, I think, and that is that we can document that the existing process is paper-based and that that it would be worth studying whether a more efficient electronic process could be provided by the clearinghouse without incurring application.
Yeah, Dave, that's exactly what I was what I had in mind. Thank you very much.
And that will get to the MP3.
I have another comment. In my point of view, it might be worth noting about the customer verification process. I mean, whether the clearinghouse should verify that the person applying for access has indeed the email address that person provides, whether the telephone number is correct, the postal address is correct. Shall we perhaps say something about the verification process?
So this is Mark. I did think about that and thought about, you know, what potential strengths that we could add into the process, especially knowing that one of the things that we're interested in here is preventing malicious conduct. But that as I started writing it, and there, actually in an earlier draft there was a section about that, I came to believe that it was an implementation detail, that the people who are actually writing up the real details of the nuts and bolts of the workflow for making this work would identify, for instance, well, do we have a list of people or IP address ranges or other identity-related information where we've seen malicious conduct in the past? What verification can we actually do? And as I started to think about it, I sort of thought, well, rather than put it into a strategy document, that's something that ought to be in an implementation plan.
So this
what
is
I
Dave.
Yes, Dave.
Given the sort of spotty, and I hesitate to use the word success, with verifying the information submitted and used for the WHOIS system, I would really like us to sort of eat our own dog food and say, verification is really important, and at least if nowhere else in the system, we're going to verify that the people who use this service are whom they claim to be, and they do have the email they claim to use, and they can be reached at the postal address they claim to claim to receive mail from. I think we're really sort of, this shouldn't be an implementation thing. This, in my mind, and again, this is speaking for myself, and I'm a very very outspoken about this in the WHOIS community. We really ought to be checking who's doing this stuff more than we do, and the number of people that have to be contacted in this particular case is small enough and manageable enough where it could be a good case study.
Well, this is Mark again. I'm happy to make that change. Maybe what I'll do is I'll work with you on some language around that.
We can make it like Gattaca.
What's that, Dave?
I said we can make it like Gattaca. A little DNA sample.
Nice. Hey, yeah. It looks like you've had your hand up for a while.
Sorry, may I make another, the last comment? It's in regards to, in the very end of section 4.2.1, it says that the registration service agent will return an accept-reject notification to the consumer. Also,
later under section 4.2.2, it mentions that the ZFA registration agent, which would issue a formal notification to consumer. I just thought that the function of notifying the consumer fits better to the registries rather than to the clearinghouse. Because as I would engineer the process, is that the clearinghouse generates passwords and provides them to the registries, and the registries then run their own checks, whatever they want to run, and if they do accept the customer, they just enable the set of credentials, and then they can just send an email to the customer because they already have the customer's email address. To my mind, it looks simpler than registries going back to the clearinghouse and notifying that they have accepted the customer and then asking clearinghouse to email the customer.
This was a question that also came up when Dave sent me some comments. And I think it's a misunderstanding of what acceptance of a customer means. My understanding of this, Vlad, was that, what I was hoping that the language got to, was that as long as the customer had no history of malicious action, as long as we could verify that they were, in some sense, who they say they were, and as long as they accepted the legal agreements, my understanding was that the registries didn't get an accept or deny opportunity. That it was something, and those three things, seeing whether or not they were on a list of malicious actors, second of all, verifying that they are who they say they are in some modulo, some amount of DNA, and then third, accepting the legal agreement, that those three tasks were things that the clearinghouse could do, shifting that work away from each one of the registries.
What I would do, I would provide the registry an option. When setting up the relationships between the clearinghouse and the registry, I would provide the registry an option. Two options. First option is to auto-accept all the applications that are coming, provided that the clearinghouse does whatever checks it seems fit. The second option is not to accept the verification of the clearinghouse and do any additional checks. Maybe in the second case, the function of further relationships and notifying the consumer would be rather delegated to the registry or something like that.
I'm hoping someone else speaks up here. It's sort of my feeling that I don't understand what either the policy or technical reason would be for the second case.
Well, VeriSign said that they have some quite advanced system for verifying customers, and I don't want them to. They did not say what exactly their system was, what the business rules are, but I would rather not deprive them of the possibility to run the same checks as they're running now.
Okay, I'm just, from my point of view, I'm going to just leave that as a discussion item for the group.
I guess I'm not seeing where we're actually precluding anybody from doing that further check. It's really just an implementation detail. So,
VeriSign or whoever can further scrutinize people who are applying for these and accept or reject them. I don't think what anything that's written up here would actually impose on them. So, in fact, it's their discretion to accept or reject on their own terms. So, I think we're covered. I guess that's why there may be some confusion here. I think we're already covered in this, at least if I'm understanding the question properly.
Well, maybe what we should do is not to mention who these functions are like, who will be responsible for all these functions, such as notification of the consumer. Maybe we should leave that open for the party that will implement the clearinghouse.
Yeah, I think that we've got a recommendation here that can be, you know, as far as implementation goes, the actual nuts and bolts of it, as long as we get the main overall goals met, implementation, as long as the registries can support it, I think we're in good shape. Maybe you're right as far as not, you know, making it a little more vague, but I think we could probably handle that in some edits back and forth discussion on the paper.
This is Craig, kind of sounds to me like we're going back to the credentialing versus the authenticating discussion. Unless I'm not understanding what we're talking about with the term authenticating, but if
it's authentication during the credentialing process, right? I guess that's authenticating the person applying for it is who they say they are and all that. And VeriSign apparently has something that I think we discussed that, and it's really they're making sure that the address and things are correct and real, but and making a phone call. I don't know how advanced that is, but it's certainly more than just accepting.
Well, you know, there's going to be community input to the implementation plan, and certainly consumers and data providers will continue to have, you know, be able to express what they think is right and what's wrong with the process. So, I think I agree with Rod that we've covered our bases with this. And I also agree with Mark that, you know, there are lots of implementation details that need to get sorted out after this group completes its work and submits its recommendation.
Yeah, and that needs to be, you know, have community input and all that on it as well.
Exactly.
So, right. And I think as long as we've got that there, and we may note the issues, that as long as I think the main thing is to acknowledge that registries may have a further process that they want to scrutinize applicants under, in addition to whatever the base level is the clearinghouse does, and that's fine. They could do that.
Well, we're winding down with about 20 minutes left in the call. I know that we've got Rod slated for the last 10 minutes. I think it's probably good. It might actually take a little bit more time than that. So I think I do want to, unless anyone has anything burning that they want to say about the paper now, I suggest that they submit their comments to the group. I think it's best that they be shared openly with everyone, so we're all on the same page and there are no surprises when the next version comes out. And if we could ask folks to stick to the timeline that Mark had outlined at the beginning, and I think I did as well, that comments and edits and questions due in by Tuesday, for a turnaround by Wednesday, for another discussion next Thursday. I think we should move on to Rod's portion of the agenda. So Rod, what I'm going to do is, we already have presenter status. What I need to do is get your... Now, Rod, Mark and I tested this out earlier today, and it does work, but it's slow. Meaning,
okay,
if you try and change something or flip something around, it does, there's a bit of a lag. So so you should have control now.
Okay, let's see. Just trying to make that one column D wider, so we don't have a bunch of numbers. Is it in there? All right. Now, I did have one comment on the paper, and that was the additional before I get into this, the additional recommendation section. I guess what should be section 5. We definitely want to address the thing we were talking about on the last call and previous to that, which is the ability to tweak the zone file access agreement so that a registry can enter into a direct agreement with a third party to distribute the files. That's a pretty major topic area. So I'll put something up on the list on that to make sure we're all, you know, that's got to be something we all discuss. So.
Thanks, Rod. That's helpful.
So I just actually, while we were going through the paper there, I was playing with the spreadsheet on my own bit, and I found a mistake, so I nailed to a new one. One of the assumptions wasn't making changes in some of the costs, so when you went and changed things, it was not showing up. Let me see if I've got. I'm not seeing. Oh, I'll hit request control. You are now in control. Let's see if that worked. Oh, what does that mean? Oh, there it is slow. Okay. So, explain what we've got here. What I've done is I've taken all of the assumptions, et cetera, that are at least the main ones. There's a few little ones that are out in there, but all the main ones about that drive this, is just how many registries, the costs involved for personnel and things like that, and brought them, all those assumptions, to the one screen with some comments on it and highlighted different in colors where you can make changes to drive the model. Then up above, we have the four different models that we originally talked about with this protocol standardization, the clearinghouse, repository, and proxy models. And the numbers up above are, those numbers are the costs to a particular registry of whichever level that is, or in the case of a consolidator, where you have a either clearinghouse or some sort of data pusher or repository, that would be their costs under those models and under the assumptions you've chosen down below. So if you make a change, and I've actually got the first one highlighted there, which is the biggest one, which is, are we talking about today, or are we talking about down the road where we have hundreds of registries? So the numbers that are showing up there on top right now are, you know, in the future. If I change that to a zero, for example, the numbers change and goes down a lot lower, obviously, because we have a lot fewer players in the market, so the cost should go down. So that's kind of common sense check number one, that it's actually reflecting that. On the left side are where I've got to click now are the different sizes of registries, small, medium, large, their cost. And then over on the right, on the other side, this gray column G, this is the delta. And actually, let's see if I can widen column I here. Hey, it worked. There we go. Now I've got real control. Cool. This is the delta based from the baseline. I'm considering the baseline just basically doing protocol standardization. And that there wouldn't really be a change. There's no consolidator in that case. And there's no real difference it's kind of an assumed no difference in cost to the registries other than something they may have to absorb up front to change their if there's some sort of standardization they'd have to do to make a change in the way their formats are or something like that. And I basically ignored that. I do have a degree in economics from way back, and I assumed that away. So if you know your economics classes, that's one of the best things you could ever do in class, is that you can assume things away. There's some numbers down below where you can play with things like the number of subscribers, the number of registries, and the market sizing area, and there's some instructions on the right on how that works. Oh, this is actually working pretty slick now. Then I have things that are cost drivers. So this is amount of man hours, person hours, whatever you want to call it, to do different activities. You can change those. So if I change, let's say, coping with changes, and I decide that's really hard to do, and that's going to take 5 hours per year to do, then up above, the numbers have changed. I've got quite a bit more cost in it. Now I'm seeing numbers that are reflecting that, and then the deltas, you can see what they are between the different models. So I'll put that one back. Point two. There we go. That's point two. It's really hard to see. Okay. And then there's some other costs that are and there's some comments on them as to what they are. I don't know if the comment thing is going to work on the control. Oh, yeah, there it is. And this describes what these are within. Some of this is there's going to be, even if you have the clearinghouse, for example, doing a whole bunch of administrative work, there's still some administrative work on the behalf of the registry. So, for example, taking on a new customer, the clearinghouse is going to do some vetting, but the registry is probably going to do some vetting of their own, too, so they don't get a free lunch there, so to speak. But you can determine, you know, is it 20% that they get as what they have to pay versus what they were paying without that, or is it more? So you can play with that there. Further down, so one of the other things I have here is base amount of headcount just to provide a service at all, and that's those numbers there. It's basically, if you have to provide this, you have to have at least some portion of a person dedicated just to make sure the thing's running, if nothing else. You don't really get away, you can't get away from that. And that doesn't vary with the number of subscribers, it's just a baseline. So that's why it's there. And it's a very small number. It's inferring that if you have zero people actually using it, you don't have to spend much time on that. But it does drive some of the cost numbers. And then finally, down the bottom is a section on the zone file data characteristics themselves. And this is number of domains in the registry, the size of the zone files in bytes. Now, this one kind of assumes the implementation of zip format, if I remember correctly. And then whether or not there's DNSSEC involved. So if I change the, if I turn on the DNSSEC bit, then the amount of data goes up. And so under models like the, I'll scroll back up here, models like the repository model, those costs are actually higher now. At least they should be. And that's the way it works on my spreadsheet. So hopefully that's the same there. So anyways, I've basically divided the sections up of assumptions into three different areas: your the data itself, the cost drivers, the physical cost drivers, and then the market drivers, so that you can then play with it and come up with numbers. And the numbers that are in there are kind of a combination of things that the group came up with, and that I came up with, and Mikey came up with, and we put it all in there, and kind of makes sense. So,
Rod, what was the error that you said you detected?
The one here on the number of new subscriptions annually was not driving. It was the formulas in the back on one of the other tabs were referring to the wrong row. So I could put let's try that right now. If I put in 100. You won't see a change other than the consolidated row. The consolidated row is right, but if you had 100, this is basically how much am I going to have to deal with adding new people to the model?
Right.
And
okay.
It didn't change in the various models, so the new model I have fixed that problem.
Okay. Thanks.
My apologies for that. I caught it as I was what I was doing was tweaking all the variables, and I'd forgotten obviously to tweak that variable and make sure it actually made changes. Before I sent it out to you last night. So. But that's it. Tried to simplify as much as possible. There's still a lot of, it's a fairly complex model when you can dig into the various, calculations and things like that to see how the numbers are treated in other tabs. But I tried to give you all the knobs and dials and put them all in one spot so you can see them all and get a description of what they are, so there'd be less questions about what they are and what they do, and hopefully make it a little easier for people to put their own assumptions in and see what drives costs. Any questions?
Nice work.
I got to thank Mikey for putting together most of this model. I just, you know, put a cover page on it, so to speak.
Rod, this is Mikey. I have just sort of a reality check question for you. So I just added up, if you look at sort of rows 6 through 9, I added up columns B through F for each of the options.
Mm-hmm.
So for row 6 today, you know, the standardization, the total of all of those is about 1,000,190. The total for row 7 with the clearinghouse is almost precisely the same. It's slightly more expensive. Oh, but wait, this is today? No. Yeah, this is projected. So one of the interesting pieces of analysis that we might want to do between now and next week is to check that, because basically the way the model sits right now, it swings, all four of the options swing the cost less than 1% total.
Well, okay, so, right, but remember, this is a per registry number that's on that, you know, on those columns and rows, right? So if we had one small registry, one medium registry, one large registry, and one registry, right, you'd have to take those numbers and multiply it by the number of registries to get the overall cost of the system. Right, so
okay. I think one of the things we might want to add to this front page is that sort of overall cost, so that people can say, ah, if we do this thing,
right,
here's the, hopefully, savings. I mean, you know, that's what this is all about, is
right,
hopefully this saves money.
Yeah, that's what you have. We've done, and I don't remember which tab it is on the the highlights tab.
Yeah,
if I remember right, from the previous model. What that the highlights doesn't have in it is some of these other fixed cost things that got added in the subsequent work. So,
yeah.
I could probably make a pretty easy tweak to do that. And what that, you know, so what that will show, and this is, you know, I know we've come to a consensus. I don't want to rock the boat on that, but you know, from an industry efficiency standpoint, as soon as you start doing the, gee, what is the effect of society kind of question, you know, moving to a repository model or a proxy model saves a ton of inefficiency. So, I mean, that's in there, but you know, we've gone through that. So,
I'm just thinking we might want to
expose costs.
We might just want to hit people in the eye with it, because this might well be the page that everybody stays at.
Right.
And so we might want to just pull a little section forward from somewhere else so that you can tweak the model and see what the impact on all of society is by your tweaking.
Right. Yeah, basically what I could do with that is come up with maybe another column that is the, you know, overall impact of each of the models, not get all the details on just one number, and then what's the delta between that and basically doing nothing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you could put it down in like rows 32 through 55, stick it over in that nice little empty space in columns J through M.
And all I have to do is multiply the numbers up above times the number of actual registries. You got it.
Yeah, something like that would be. Because I think it's really, you know, one of the big objectives of the model is to demonstrate that value of this whole thing.
Right.
And, this would be a great place to do it.
Okay, I will do that.
All right.
In fact, I'll get that out. I got a plane trip I'm going to have, so I'll have plenty of time to make that tweak. So I'll get that out tomorrow.
John, I see your hand up in the queue, or hand up in the room.
Yeah, on the transfers per sub, wouldn't monthly sort of 12 downloads per sub, a weekly 52 and daily 365 make more sense than having 100, 250, and 365?
Oh, you're looking at...
The experts per sub, the assumptions
right.
on subscription frequency.
Yeah, I debated whether or not to bring that part of the model out or not. Yeah, something like that. And that, this is one of those sub-details that was from the original work we did. I just left it alone, but we could certainly surface that one if we wanted to and make it so people could tweak that a little easier. That's one of the buried, those little, what I call the little buried assumptions.
That's just unusual.
Yeah, yeah. No, I
think
agree.
That one's fine.
Yeah.
I don't have any strong feelings about that.
Yeah, like 12, 52, 365 or something like that, you were saying.
It makes a bit more sense because that's how I think a lot of Zone 5 consumers would actually download.
Right.
So you'd have the heavy downloaders sort of probably taking most of the bandwidth, whereas the sort of the small consumers might be quite negligible in the overall scheme of things.
Right. Do that and make some changes. So something like what I don't know if you're seeing on the screen what I'm doing right now.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah, that's basically what you're talking about. And then you can go back and take a look here, and boom. So what I can do, I don't, you know, didn't really. Well, actually, I think that did change a little bit. But I could actually surface that because that's actually pretty easy. There's only three numbers there, right? So I'll surface that in the assumptions part, so we can do that. Good suggestion. Thanks.
Thanks, Rod. So we are right at the top of the hour. Lots of good discussion today and inputs to getting us to the next version of the paper. And Rod, appreciate the demonstration on the cost model and the tweaks that you're going to make send back around. I do think we need to figure out how do we share this and to what extent do we share it relative to the paper and beyond, and I think we're just going to need to sort that out on the list within, you know, the next week or so. Are there any closing remarks or comments that people would like to make before we break today? Seeing none, everyone have a good rest of your Thursday. We look forward to seeing your edits and remarks as soon as possible and definitely by Tuesday and turning around another version of the paper shortly. So thank you. Bye, guys.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.